Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, world. I'm back. I'm the Format. This station is called Format FM. It's named after me. It's my creation. And this is my new show. It lasts roughly an hour, and it's me talking about stuff. So get ready. Today we got three articles coming your way. This first one is from humansarefree.com. I also have one from ancientorigins.net, and the main event today is actually from cbsnews.com, which may be disappointing to some of you who only want alternative content, but this is a pretty cool story coming from the FBI, so I'm actually excited to share it with you. But I will just get right into it. So the first story today is called, As Food Lines Grow and Businesses Are Forced to Shut Down, Government Gives $140 Million in COVID Relief to Child Traffickers, Murderers, and Rapists. This is by Matt Agarist. When the politicians, on taxpayer-funded salaries, sit around and discuss which businesses to keep open and which businesses to shut down, they never consider limiting their salaries or cutting their funding. They simply force people out of business and offer nothing in return. In states that do offer some relief to shuttered businesses, the programs fall far short of the mark for small business owners, enrich already large corporations, or, as the following case illustrates, puts millions in the pockets of murderers, rapists, and child traffickers, some of whom are on death row. Scott Peterson, convicted of killing his wife and unborn son, Carrie Stainer, convicted of murdering two women and children, and Isaro Aguirre, convicted of torturing an 8-year-old girl to death, all have two things in common. The first thing is that they're all on death row in California prisons. And the second thing is that they, along with murderers, rapists, and child traffickers in 35 California prisons, have received pandemic relief amounting to over $140 million. The LA Times reported that this was the most significant fraud on taxpayer funds in California history, according to a letter obtained by the Times. It is a manifest problem that cannot be ignored, and the governor needs to take steps to address it, said McGregor Scott, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California. Prosecutors told the Times that the fraud is entirely and easily preventable, and they asked Governor Newsom to step in and turn off the spigot of payments to incarcerated people. However, according to Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert, who helped form and lead a task force on the issue, the Employment Development Department, or EDD, seems unconcerned with the problem. The El Dorado County District Attorney Vern Pearson said the EDD is just a dysfunctional mess. Schubert and District Attorney Cynthia Zimmer of Kern County said the alleged fraud was taking multiple forms. Some claims may have been submitted by inmates directly or by family and friends to whom they gave their personal information. Other inmates may be unwitting victims, according to the Times. Adding to the insidious nature of giving violent felons millions of dollars is the fact that some of them are using this money to post million-dollar bail amounts and get out. According to the report, in total, nearly $1 billion was paid out fraudulently through the relief system. The murderers and rapists and human traffickers should not be getting this money, said Schubert. It needs to stop. We agree. Had the government implemented the easy security practices, the fraud would have been minimal. Instead, those who wanted to exploit the system were able to steal money from people who desperately need it in a situation that's akin to taking candy from a baby. In fact, it is so easy that even though this investigation was launched, the fraud continues. Really, at this point, stopping the bleed is the most important thing because the fraud is continuing, said Fresno District Attorney Lisa Smitkamp, who has found about 860 questionable claims from inmates at Pleasant Valley State Prison, amounting to about $3.6 million. These are just random cash cards they are sending out, and they are being completely irresponsible with taxpayer money. Had Newsom's office devoted more resources to relief packages and less time to enforcing ridiculous Thanksgiving police state measures, perhaps child-murdering rapists wouldn't have been able to steal such a massive amount of money. The result is the same, however, and the $1 billion that could have gone to feeding hundreds of thousands of Californians who are unemployed and in the midst of a food crisis went to child traffickers and murderers. As the TFTP reported, this food crisis is very real. Though many of the signs are obvious, like thousands of cars lining up in Dallas, Texas to get food handouts, other signs are unfolding behind the scenes and are affecting millions. According to an analysis from Feeding America, food insecurity will hit 52 million people due to COVID-19 in the United States, which is an increase of 17 million people from pre-pandemic times. Supply line disruptions, lower levels of donations, and millions of unemployed people who've lost their jobs due to government-imposed lockdowns have created a massive strain on America's food supply, and more families are being pushed into a situation of food insecurity. In the meantime, government leaders seemingly couldn't care less about the plight of the people and continue to force businesses to close while offering zero support. And as this case illustrates, when they do offer support, it is in the form of a wasteful disaster that allows criminals to steal taxpayer money. It's not just the brink of starvation that millions of Americans face either. Thanks to government-mandated lockdowns, a record number of Americans are unable to find jobs, as businesses are forced to close or have gone out of business permanently. This is creating a situation in which families are unable to pay their rent, leading to the potential for mass evictions. In March, the CARES Act imposed a federal moratorium on evictions, which mandated that it was illegal to evict tenants who participate in federal housing assistance programs or who live in properties with a federally backed mortgage loan due to the non-payment of rent. When the CARES Act moratorium expired on July 24th, a host of state and local governments passed their own eviction prevention measures. But these actions varied significantly across the country and left many renters vulnerable to eviction once again. Then, on September 4th, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued another moratorium on evictions through December 31st, 2020. While this will certainly help those who rent temporarily, all the moratorium did was pass the burden onto the landlord, who may no longer be able to pay the mortgage on the property without the incoming rent. And no, contrary to what many believe, most landlords are not mega-rich property owners and actually live modest lifestyles. In fact, according to an analysis by the Brookings Institute, 40% of residential property units are owned by individual investor landlords. Among those owning residential investment property, roughly a third are from low to moderate income households. Property income constitutes up to 20% of their total household income. Now, as hundreds of millions go to murderers, rapists, and human traffickers instead of the taxpayers who need it, without some sort of assistance, another massive crisis is unfolding. The moratorium doesn't forgive rent payments, it only allows the renter to defer them. However, if a tenant cannot come up with the monthly rent right now, the idea of paying back multiple months of compounded rent after the moratorium is over will be all but impossible. This lack of income will then be passed to the small business landlord, who will then default on their loan payments, and these houses will be repossessed by the banks. Given that the majority of rental homes are owned by individual, mom-and-pop operations, not massive real estate companies, the resultant defaults could be catastrophic. Bank-owned homes will likely not be subject to a moratorium and the occupants will be thrown out on the street. One would think that government would be paying attention to these food and housing crises and take action to prevent the inevitable collapse that will ensue with their current policies in place. That action would That action would come in the form of rental assistance or other relief packages that could prevent such a devastating chain reaction of default and subsequent eviction. Unfortunately, however, government is allowing these programs to be exploited and stolen from. And this was a story from humansarefree.com by Matt Agarist. Thanks to Matt and humansarefree.com. So thank you very much, and I hope you don't sue me. Next up, another person whose story I'm sharing with you in hopes that I don't get sued. This is called The Mysterious Didanum People. This is from ancientorigins.net by John Black. And I think this is the Didanum people or Didanum people. I'm not exactly sure how to say it. It's D-I-D-A-N-U-M. One of the races mentioned in sacred texts, especially Bible texts, are the Didanum people, or Ditanu or Tidanu, the precursors of the Nephilim and Rephaim, going back to 3000 BC. There are not many references to this race, however, we will try to touch upon what is known about them. Many already know about the Nephilim, the offspring of the sons of God, and the daughters of men, beings of gigantic size with incredible abilities and powers who are associated with the demigods of all different religions and mythologies. In the same category belong the Rephaim, who were also beings of enormous stature and powerful abilities, a generation of heroes. Furthermore, references to the Rephaim in the Bible identify them as shades or spirits, giving another dimension to their existence, as if they were able to interact or manifest at the same time in different realities. The god El. In ancient texts, it seems that the Didanites are very closely related to the Rephaim, making them another race related to the gods of the past. In the Epic of Crete, a Canaanite epic of the Bronze Age, which is written in the Ugaritic language found on three clay tablets, God El, the father of gods according to Canaanites, also identified with the Egyptian god Ptah, promises King Crete that the glory of his family is going to be restored. It mentions the assembly of the Ditanites, referring to the Didanum people. King Crete was a descendant of the Didanites and a ruler of the region around the mountain of the Amorites, as well as Didanum Mountain. The importance of the Didanum people was significant, since the presence of the Council of the Didanites was required during the ascension of the kings. References to this text may also identify Amorites with the Didanums. Amorites, or Tidnum in Akkadian, were a group of people from ancient Syria who lived around 2000 to 3000 BC. The Syrian region Jebel Bishri is what they called the Mountain of the Amorites. Whether Amorites just used the term Didanum or if they were the Didanum people is not known. Furthermore, in one Sumerian poem called The Descent of Inanna to the Netherworld, the Didanum people are referred to as an enemy of Inanna, who, if you don't know, is a Sumerian goddess of sexual love, fertility, and warfare. In other texts, Didanites appear to be connected to Dedan, or Dedan, who also appears to be an important god of the Nubians in Egypt. It is interesting to notice that Dedan was a descendant of Noah. The people of Dedan were warned by the god that his wrath was going to fall upon them because Dedan questioned the motives of God, in the same way that all descendants of the Nephilim were executed by Joshua with the help of God, leaving no traces of them. Concluding what we can say about the Didanum people is that they were gigantic people, probably descendants of the gods, with great physical and mental power associated in some ways with the royal dynasties of the past. They were so important that their name has been used later on as a title for important royal people. What happened to them and how did they come to exist is unknown. But the important thing is that we have reference to another strange race of giants amongst humanity that suddenly disappeared. And again, this is by John Black from AncientOrigins.net. And a little shout out here to this book. It's called The Legend of King Kuret, a Canaanite epic of the Bronze Age. So if you're interested, go check out the book. Again, it's called The Legend of King Kuret, and that's K-E-R-E-T, Kuret, or something like that. And now, this is the story I was telling you about before from CBSNews.com. A couple notes. I've had to edit this down quite a bit because there's a lot of short quotes. So, unfortunately, it's going to be this person said, that person said quite frequently. And I have some main characters here. So, here's what I'm going to do. We've got Trey Watts is a person who was on the phone. So I'll probably just call him Trey. Main character here, Steve Richardson, former FBI special agent. So Steve Richardson will just be Steve. Molly Ammon is an FBI profiler. I will just call her Molly. We have Kevin Cornelius. He is an FBI commander and FBI hostage rescue team member. So I will just call him Kevin. So we'll have Kevin, Steve, Molly, Trey, Bill Rafferty, what does Bill Rafferty do? I believe he was a police officer, but I'm not 100% sure at the moment. I'll find out in a minute. But anyway, this story is called Saving Ethan, the FBI's race against the clock to rescue kidnapped Alabama boy. In January 2013, an armed man jumped on a school bus packed with children in Midland City, Alabama. Jimmy Lee Dykes shot and killed the driver and kidnapped 5-year-old Ethan Gilman and took him to a heavily fortified underground bunker. In a race against time, FBI hostage negotiators and members of the elite FBI hostage rescue team recount their elaborate plan to breach the bunker and rescue Ethan. Steve Richardson, who we'll call Steve, says, "Kidnappings are incredibly difficult for a number of different reasons. There's a child's life at stake. Emotions are high. Time is of the essence." Molly, the FBI profiler. "When the entire FBI machine spins up on one case acting in concert, it takes your breath away." When Trey Watts calls 911, he says he doesn't know where the emergency is, but says that he's on a bus and someone is trying to take their kids. The 911 operator asks if he's sure someone is trying to take a kid, and Trey responds, "Yes, ma'am." Trey said, "I was on that bus that day when I called 911. It was a normal day, just like any other. I usually sat in the third seat from the back. We're dropping off the kids, and I feel a big lurch on the bus, and I look up and I notice a guy is on the bus and he has a gun pointed at Mr. Poland's head. Steve, if my children were on a school bus, I would want someone like Charles Poland defending them. You can't do th-" he said, "You can't do this. I will not let you take the children." Kevin Cornelius, former commander and FBI hostage rescue team member. "He was asking for two kids that are certain ages. He was asking for children to come forward." Trey says he just kept saying over and over, I need the kids, I need the kids, I need the kids. Jim Dykes, I need two kids, two boys. They will not be harmed, you won't be harmed. Charles Poland, it's my responsibility. Jim Dykes, I can't help that. Charles Poland, I need to keep these kids on the bus. Jim Dykes, I can't help that, I can't help that. Charles Poland, I can't turn them over to anybody else. Steve, every time I listen to this dialogue, cold chills run up my spine. Kevin, the majority of the kids ran to the back, and even as he was in there and he was talking to Mr. Poland, he was making his demands. Kids would come out of a seat and they would go two or three seats back. Jim Dykes, I'm gonna have to shoot you now. Come on, I don't have any time. The goddamn law's coming. Come on, don't. Trey, and at that point, Mr. Poland proceeds to try to pull off. The guy pulls the gun out. 911 operator, what's going on? Trey, the bus driver's dead. 911 operator, he what? Trey, the bus driver's dead. Trey, and at that point, he took Ethan off the bus. There's school bus surveillance video recordings of kids crying as Jim Dykes yells, come here, come here, come here. Steve, little Ethan was sitting on the first seat behind Chuck Poland. News report, we understand the man is holding that child in a bunker on his property. Steve said Jim Dykes introduced himself to a 911 operator on the phone, but it was cut short. Jim, I'm in an underground bunker. Operator, you're in an underground bunker? Okay, sir, you have a child with you? Jim, yes. Steve, the bunker was 6x8x12 feet straight down. The way that he had constructed the bunker, he was very proud of his project. Kevin, there's a lot of options that the hostage rescue team practices on a daily basis. Not necessarily a bunker that's 12 feet down in the ground. 911 operator, attention all units, be advised. I have suspect on 911, is armed, does have the child hostage. He's in an underground bunker. Sir, is the child harmed? Hello? I just lost the guy. Jim Dykes called back and gave very specific instructions to law enforcement. He said when the cops get there, they can talk to him. They can stop at the front gate. Steve, the ironic thing is, he was incredibly winded, so I know Ethan was fighting him. Jim Dykes to 911. They can stop there and talk to a white post, a white PVC pipe sticking up. Steve said he talked about a talking tube down by the gate and said there was no longer going to be communicating via cell phone. The only way he would communicate with law enforcement was via that speaking tube. Kevin, at the bunker. As I recall, the PVC pipe was the talking tube and it was 170 feet from just outside the gate to where the bunker is back here. And it was just kind of like a string in a can. You'd be able to talk from one end to the other and be able to hear the voice. Steve said that it was all orchestrated. It was all part of his master plan. According to him, he had a story to tell. Molly, we did not know the nature of the story, only that he thought that once the public became aware of his story, there would be riots in the street and potentially a revolution of some sort. Steve, it became very clear that Ethan was a pawn for Dykes to carry out his very well orchestrated plan, at least in his mind. News report, negotiators are trying to talk with the suspect and the boy. Steve, we had a hostage situation active and live. We had a murder. We had a bad guy. We had a bad guy that was incredibly unpredictable. He had planned this out for months and months and months. He was going to execute his plan, regardless of what happened. Day 1. For 7 days, beginning in January 2013, hundreds of law enforcement agents were focused on rescuing Ethan Gilman, the 5-year-old kindergartner, was held hostage in an underground bunker in rural Alabama by Jimmy Lee Dykes. Bill Rafferty of the Houston County Sheriff's Department was among the first to arrive. Bill says, "We pulled up and parked on 231 at the entrance to the dirt road here, exited the vehicle and came up here. Right here in this area was a 6x8-foot bunker underground. Authorities quickly realized this was a time-sensitive situation and called in the FBI. Steve, I was taking care of some of the normal routine tasks that came my way, and one of our bomb technicians came up. He said, 'Boss, we've got a problem.' We started deploying all the assets that we had based upon the information that was available to help solve the problem. Deputies soon learned that Jimmy Lee Dykes and the man he had just brutally murdered, bus driver Charles Poland, knew each other. Every school day, Poland would drive the bus up the private road where Dykes lived after dropping kids off. Poland had to make a U-turn to go back down the hill. Sheriff Wally Olson of Dale County, Alabama, said that Jim befriended Mr. Poland. He'd actually dug out an area for the bus to be able to turn around. But investigators say Dykes wasn't doing this to be helpful. He had an ulterior motive: to get on Charles Poland's bus, take hostages, and use them as pawns in a twisted effort to share his grievances with the world. Dykes was no stranger to law enforcement. A deputy recorded a confrontation between Dykes and a neighbor 2 years earlier, a dispute over the nuts from a pecan tree. Jim Dykes said in a November 16, 2011 recording, "I mean, he's an absolute idiot. What if they're growing bananas there? You can't pick up bananas either there, could ya?" With Jimmy Lee Dykes, even the simplest spat could trigger a tirade. Jim Dykes in that same recording, "Republicans, Democrats, they're all the same to me. They're all crooks." Steve Richardson, "We had some information early on that he had some anti-government ideals." Bill Rafferty, "He appeared to hate everything. The government, the way things are done, the laws. In fact, Dykes had a scheduled court appearance the day after he took Ethan hostage to answer charges related to pointing a gun at another neighbor." Bill goes on to say, "My understanding, once that he gotten in trouble this last time, he started working day and night to complete the bunker. I feel that he planned this whole ordeal because of his not wanting to go to court, his not believing in the court, not believing in that he had even committed a crime. The pipe had an elbow on it, so you weren't trying to talk down into it, but you were talking into it, and it was facing this way, and this is where we were originally talking to him at. It was amazing how clear you could hear Mr. Dykes speak, and apparently he could hear us quite well, too." Jim Dykes and negotiation audio. "The politicians, they don't care. They pass laws to get votes." Bill, "I started talking with Dykes. We were listening to what he was saying, but we were also, every chance we got, trying to give him a way out." Bill in negotiation audio. "I'm listening. You don't want me to, but I'm fighting for you just like I am Ethan." Ethan had started riding the bus to school just that year. Investigators would learn he came from a troubled home and had behavioral issues. Bill says Ethan's background and his lifestyle had... I think he had been around a lot of strangers. Investigators hope that experience with strangers could help Ethan in the bunker with Jim Dykes. Bill in negotiation audio. "I want you to come out with Ethan and tell your story. That's what I want." Steve, Our negotiators were very familiar with Bill. He spent multiple weeks at Quantico training to be a certified hostage negotiator. From the FBI standpoint, that training is not easy. Jim Dykes in negotiation audio. Unless you need me, just give me a call. Bill said that when Dykes stated he was done talking for the night, he was talking no more, and they were escorted back to the church. A quarter mile down the hill from the bunker, Destiny Church became ground zero for the FBI's operation. Bill says he was informed at that point that he needed to be there the next day. They were going to put an agent talking with Dykes, but wanted him there as the coach. As day turned to night, Special Agent in Charge, Steve Richardson, sent his team out to gather whatever intel they could. Steve, our technically trained agents had gone up in the middle of the night, trying to gain access to that tube to see what they could do in order to give us any type of visibility into that bunker. What they discovered was alarming. A homemade bomb at the base of the talking tube, outside the bunker. We couldn't predict what he was going to do next. There was one thing in mind, and that was to get the little guy out of that hole as safely and as quickly as possible. Nothing more and nothing less. Day 2. When FBI discovered that Jimmy Lee Dykes had rigged a bomb at the base of the talking tube outside his bunker, the crisis escalated. Steve, it became very clear to me, very quickly, that although we have some very, very good specialty skill sets within the mobile division, we needed help, and we needed a lot of help. Richardson requested assistance from headquarters. They sent profilers from the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit and its elite hostage rescue team. Kevin, the first order of business when you get to a site like that, or to an incident as a hostage rescue group, you want to put in place an emergency hostage rescue plan. Molly, the first time I'd heard of this was when my phone rang at or after 11 p.m. at night. I was asleep in my bed. Not uncommon for our phones to ring and wake us up in the night. If we are needed, we are there. Negotiators had been talking to Dykes through that booby trap pipe, but now it was far too dangerous. Afraid it would detonate, the FBI needed a safer way for them to communicate. Steve. Day 2, the technically trained agents, along with the electronic technicians, the ETs, made a PA system and set it right here. Kevin describes it as a speaker box. Steve says it would be just the same as if they were standing right there by the pipe. So that probably pacified him a little bit. Kidnappings are incredibly difficult for a number of different reasons, said former FBI Special Agent in Charge Steve Richardson. There's a child's life at stake. Emotions are high. Time is of the essence. Agents delivered a throw phone to Dykes through the hatch he'd designed as an entrance. He could use it only to talk to law enforcement. Steve. He accepted a phone that the negotiators used and were able to talk to him very clearly, and that benefited both him and our negotiators. With that direct line to negotiators, some of which was recorded, Jimmy Lee Dykes laid out what he wanted. He said the message has got to be out there before he dies. According to Steve Richardson, his original demands were to have a reporter come down into the hole. He wanted to go live on TV. Molly. Once the reporter, a female reporter, was down there with him, his vision was that she would hold his hand while he shared his story with her, for her to broadcast to the world, and then he would commit suicide. And she would be able to let herself out of the bunker. Jim Dykes in negotiation audio. There's no way I'm walking out of here, in other words is what I'm saying. As Dykes pushed to air a long list of complaints about the government to a live TV audience, FBI profilers worked hard to analyze him. Negotiators tried to keep him calm. Steve, negotiation is a conversation. And during that conversation, you as a negotiator are trying to get the bad guy to talk. You're gathering information that might be useful down the road, good or bad. Bill in negotiation audio. We want to be able to get to the point where you can get your story out and where it will go on, where it won't die, where your message keeps going. And we want Ethan safe. Jim. Okay. Bill. And I want to look for any way we can to get there. Molly. If I could summarize our mission, it would be to hopefully bend Jim Dykes to our will. That was what we wanted to do. We wanted him to release Ethan, and persuading him to do that was everything. When the entire FBI machine spins up on one case, acting in concert, it takes your breath away. There was no mountain that the FBI would not have moved to save Ethan. FBI agents and other law enforcement professionals all over were gathering information about him, and that was critical to my understanding. I was beginning to develop a picture of Jim Dykes as an injustice collector. Jim tells negotiators, I can't trust anyone. You can't trust anyone in this society to do anything unless it's beneficial to them. Steve. He fancied himself a victim. He was playing the victim card. He had anything and everything bad that had ever happened to him in his life was someone else's fault. Molly. I don't think he even realized. I don't think he realized necessarily that we were trying to get into his head. I think that he was so focused on his mission that nothing else existed. News report. We are continuing to follow a hostage situation that is now reaching its third day. Making the situation even more complex was Ethan's need for medication for those behavioral issues. Dykes agreed to have it delivered 4 times a day. The SWAT team would drop the medication through the bunker hatch. Kevin Cornelius, now at the bunker. Whenever we would make the delivery, you would only get maybe 4 to 8 inches of visibility into the hatch. So as the medicine drops were coming in, it gave us an opportunity to learn more about the bunker itself. Agents managed to sneak a camera into the bunker, which gave them valuable information. They saw beds, a TV, snacks, and water. It was a psychological puzzle with 2 players. Molly. We were spending a lot of time analyzing Jim Dykes, but not just Jim Dykes. It was very important for us to understand his hostage. Really, the two of them were sort of orbiting each other in a codependency. Jim Dykes needed Ethan because Ethan was his only protection against assault on his position, and he knew that. Ethan needed Jim Dykes because he was the difference between life and death for Ethan. He was providing him food, water, medication, and toys. Steve. Early indications were that he may have had some type of empathy for Ethan. He may have cared for him in some way. Jim Dykes in negotiation audio. Look, isn't this child supposed to get some more medicine tonight? Negotiator. Yeah, at 7. It's only 6. Molly, the reality was that Jim Dykes had a whole life pattern of low to no empathy for other human beings, and for him to suddenly care for Ethan in an emotional way rather than a practical, utilitarian way, that would be such a dramatic break in his life pattern. While law enforcement was working around the clock, the community was coming out in force to pray for a peaceful resolution. WTVY News reports, vigils have been scheduled all across the Wiregrass area after they found a backpack on the ground with the name Ethan on it. Because of his unstable upbringing, Ethan had been in and out of foster care for most of his life, including a short stay with the Turners when he was just a toddler. The Turners had a heart-stopping realization when they heard his name on the news. Pastor Brandon Turner. He was a little bitty squirt when we had him, and so man, it just broke our heart. My oldest son still had a picture of him in his wallet. He'd got that attached to him. You pray and you hope for the best. But the more it went on and the more they described it, it didn't sound like it was going to be good. Molly. Jim Dykes was profoundly rigid, fixed on his plan, unable to see alternatives. I knew Jim Dykes to be someone who saw violence as a necessary consequence to others. I absolutely believe he was capable of killing Ethan. Day 4. News report. The suspect is still barricaded inside that underground bunker. Steve, it's a bit of a blur. I spent 17 or 18 hours a day there. Kevin, for a while, everybody can stay up for maybe 24 or 48 hours, but at some point you're going to have to start getting some rest so you can continue to make those good decisions. Steve, who could go back to bed and sleep with all this going on? I wanted to continue to work, to think, to help us solve the problem. The problems just kept mounting. The hidden camera agents managed to sneak in revealed that Dykes not only had a gun, but another homemade bomb. They could also see that Dykes was watching TV. Rhonda Brucius, in a 2013 news report, said, "This guy is gonna snap. This guy is an accident waiting to happen." Steve, we were a little bit concerned when the neighbor got on TV and described a scenario in which Dykes had killed her dog. Rhonda, he beat the dog until he thought that the dog was dead. Steve, we thought that might make Dykes mad, would inflame him again, would irritate him that someone was spreading negative information about him. If you recall, he was a victim of everything. It wasn't his fault, it was the dog's fault. To try and keep Dykes calm, the FBI came up with what might seem like an unusual plan. Steve, the only government official, from an enforcement standpoint, that he would have any respect for or recognize was the elected sheriff in the county from which he resided. So we used that to our advantage. Molly. And so what we asked Sheriff Olson to do was to publicly thank Jim Dykes for caring for Ethan. Sheriff Wally. Sheriff Wally on day 5, 2 reporters. Mr. Dykes told us that he's taking care of him. He's always allowed us to provide coloring books, medication, and toys. I want to thank him for taking care of our child. Sheriff Wally. I knew that people would look at me and say, "Why are you saying that?" You know, but at the same time, I had to stay focused on what we were trying to do. Molly. Certainly counterintuitive, perhaps, to consider a message like that, but we really wanted Jim Dykes to see himself as a hero to Ethan, as a good guy, and to help him resist any urge that he may be feeling to harm Ethan. Bill Rafferty in Negotiation Audio. He's gonna remember you. He's gonna remember how nice you were to him, how caring and lovable you were to him. Molly says, we needed Jim to keep Ethan safe in human terms, in compassionate terms, and that messaging was one of our strategies to try to achieve that. Bill tells Jim Dykes in negotiation audio, you make sure that he's safe. Please make sure he's safe. Jim says, I'm going to. Bill, while we were dealing with Dykes, you know, people behind the lines were doing a lot of other things. There was the CBs brought in, and they built a mock bunker. The CBs are the Navy's construction battalion. Kevin, these guys can build anything. They're absolutely amazing. We gave them all that the dimensions that we had, and at that point, we had ground-penetrating radar data, and behind the staging area of the hostage rescue team, the CBs built a full mock-up that we could train in. The FBI also wanted us to build a replica of the IED bomb Dykes had in the bunker and test its force. The device was located near a propane tank. Specialists knew exactly what materials to use. Agents had retrieved receipts from his garbage. Kevin. It was right in front of the mobile home that was sitting there. It was a trailer. That was actually the receipts of all the stuff that he bought to build the bomb. Both bombs. FBI bomb specialists were able to duplicate the explosive. Kevin remembered, they fired it off, you know, on demolitions range back at Quantico, and it was devastating. I think his hopes were that the propane tank would be an accelerant, that it would cause some type of ball of fire. Instead, what it turned into was a projectile. It could maim, damage, and kill anybody in its path. Brandon Turner. We all got together in a joint effort to pray, and we actually had members that tried to go as close as they could to get over there to pray for him and see if there's anything they can do. Nikki Turner. We prayed really hard, you know, for him the whole time he was down there. Molly, as the days wore on, Jim Dykes became tired, and he began to exhibit less patience with Ethan. A shorter temper even than he had previously with negotiators. The relationship between Jim Dykes and Ethan was evolving, of course, over time. It was of tremendous concern to us. A bond of an unclear nature was forming between them. Bill. Ethan told Dykes that he loved him, and that sent Dykes into a... It upset him very bad. Dykes was on a mission. It did not include having affection from a victim that he kidnapped. He would be way, way up here, and we would get him down, and get him down, and get him down, but we never could bring him down to reality. Steve. The first incident where it became incredibly intense was, we were making a medicine delivery. We were trying to film part of that. He saw the camera at one point and became incredibly irritated. Another incident, we came up and we were delivering medicine again. Dykes saw the muzzle end, the business end of an M4, and he became incredibly irritated again. Bill. And he indicated that we were trying to kill him at that point. That is when Dykes broke down. Very upset, crying. That was a key factor that took him to a place that we never... Jim Dykes, in negotiation audio. I want you to know that trigger-happy son of a bitch. He may think he's Rambo, and he may think he's gonna be a hero if he does that. But he ain't gonna be no goddamn hero when the world knows he's responsible for killing this kid. Day 6. Steve. On day 6, Dykes started making very specific demands. He was incredibly agitated. The FBI believed Jimmy Lee Dykes was upset because the phone they gave him allowed him to communicate only with negotiators. He wanted another phone so that he could directly speak to reporters covering the story, and he wasn't getting his way. Jim Dykes in negotiation audio. I can call CNN. I can call every damn body possible. Bill. Everything started deteriorating with him as far as communications, and on Sunday is when he basically gave us the deadline. If we didn't have him a hardline phone in there by 5:30 Monday afternoon, he was cutting off all communications with us. Molly. Up until that point, one of the negotiators' most reliable topics to defuse an angry situation was to ask about Ethan. Very often, Dykes would disengage from his rant and go check on Ethan and come back into the phone and report whatever Ethan was doing. Bill Rafferty in negotiation audio. Are you ready for Ethan's meds? Jim. No, what the fuck's going on about the phone? Molly. When even that began to disappear from his behavioral set, that raised concerns for us that potentially time was running out. Brandon Turner. We didn't know what was going to happen. You know, it's scary because we never had anything like that happen around here. As hundreds of law enforcement officers devised a plan to rescue Ethan, the community mourned Charles Poland, the beloved bus driver Dykes murdered. School bus driver Charles Poland was killed in the shooting. Lydia Hancock, Charles Poland's daughter. Daddy was a lot of things in the 66 years he was here on this earth. He was a brother, a son, a father, a husband, a grandfather, pawpaw. He was a funny, lovable, caring person, and there's not another person like him. Steve, Chuck Poland felt bad for Dykes. Mr. Poland was smart enough to know he didn't have any friends and probably knew his reputation. Lydia, Daddy had given him a jar of jelly and a dozen eggs that morning. Steve, so he was trying to help a neighbor, like most everyone would do in this particular community. Try to help out one another. And this was Dykes' repayment. Molly, it became clear that Dykes was isolated. He had no tethers to emotion, to friends or family, and so one of my challenges was to come up with a strategy to help him overcome that. And the ideal would be for him to want to bond with someone outside the bunker. Agents believed finding such a person was their best hope of saving Ethan and getting Dykes to surrender. They learned Dykes has two daughters and he hadn't seen them in years. Steve, and one of the daughters agreed to come here and, if needed, have a conversation with him if it would help save the child. Cindy Dykes told the Wall Street Journal about her conversation with the FBI. They asked when the last time I had talked to him, and I told them I hadn't seen or heard from him since I was 10 or 11, and I told them whatever they needed. I had a little boy the same age. As agents spent the weekend prepping his daughter, Dykes spun further out of control, even taunting the agents. Jim Dykes in negotiation audio. You just go ahead and send some motherfucker down here. That goddamn tunnel up there to their death. Molly, Jim Dykes had a mission. That mission was failing. He was not given the reporter down in the bunker. He was not given a platform to speak to the media and air his story to the world. Nothing was working out the way he wanted it to. Day 7. Bill Rafferty. Going into Monday, he went on a very long rant. Dykes in negotiation audio. You know goddamn well I'm smarter than most of you fucking people. I have the experience. I have the ability and I have the balls to show just how fucking corrupt this goddamn system is. Steve, if his demands were not met, he was going to blow up himself and Ethan. Molly, Jim Dykes began handling his firearm, which we felt he was rehearsing behaviors prior to potentially setting off the improvised explosive device he had in the bunker. Kevin, he talked about teaching Ethan how to set off the IED inside. Molly, nothing good was happening. I certainly was profoundly alarmed for Ethan's safety, as I think we all were. Kevin, and I think that all led us to a decision point. After a week of failed negotiations, it was time for drastic action. The team ran a plan by their then FBI director, Robert Mueller, and his top brass. They'd been following the situation all week. And it was during that call with Director Mueller that we went over, it seemed like, everything that we had done since day one to make sure that we didn't miss anything. Molly. And what I told the director was that Jim Dykes was taking care of Ethan's physical needs. Yes, he was feeding him. Yes, he was giving him toys. Yes, he was giving him his medications. But it would be a grave error in my judgment to, from that, assume that somehow Ethan was safe in Jim Dykes' care. With Ethan still in the bunker after a week of failed negotiations, it was time for drastic action. Steve, we had expressed to them that this was not going to end well unless we did something. That's where Dykes' daughter came in. The FBI planned to set up a computer video chat between the two. Molly, he even asked for a comb to comb his hair. He asked for a clean shirt. He wanted himself and Ethan to be presentable for that encounter. FBI headquarters gave the hostage rescue team the green light to move in only if the opportunity presented itself. Steve, Ethan had to be in a safe space. He had to be out of sight, away from the shaft of the bunker. Dykes had to come up the ladder and receive a computer. Molly, I wanted this to be the moment that turned things around. I wanted to believe that this opportunity to reconnect with his daughter could be a game changer for us, but it wasn't. Go time. Kevin, how could we get Dykes in a position and ensure that Ethan was in a position that we could carry out an effective hostage rescue? After Jimmy Lee Dykes accepted a computer for a video chat with his daughter, the FBI was able to see that Ethan was far enough away from Dykes to initiate its rescue plan. Steve, we were staged, ready to go, and the criteria that had to be met was met, and the execute order was given. Kevin, we were in the command post. We had a live video feed from the surveillance reconnaissance aircraft that we had in front of us. Steve, it was very quiet in the command post. Somber. I called my wife and said, I can't tell you why, but I'm asking you to pray. For the safety of our people and the safety of Ethan. Kevin, all of this in my mind was going to take 7 seconds, at least if everything went right. This was the moment hostage rescue team members, known as operators, had been preparing for all week. It was go time. They blew the hatch open. Steve, I watched the first operator approach the bunker. He jumped in, and as we all knew that he would, and then I saw the second operator go behind him, and he tried to jump in, and couldn't. I immediately knew there was a problem. Dykes had set a booby trap, a snake pit of cables blocking the way into the bunker. Making matters worse, he started shooting at the operators. Steve, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. He had cover at the bottom of the bunker, and he's firing as fast as he can at our guys. Kevin, how's the number one operator not hit? I'm not sure, but they were able to pull the number one operator back up. Obviously, speed, surprise, violence of action is what we're looking for in a hostage rescue, so we needed to regain surprise at some point. Moments later, they threw in stun grenades. This would temporarily disorient Dykes and give hostage rescue team specialists, known as breachers, time to clear the cables. In the midst of the chaos, Dykes triggered that bomb outside the talking tube. Steve, it backfilled the bunker with smoke, so the visibility was next to zero. Kevin, there was a long silence as the cable cutting was going on. Really didn't know what was happening. I saw people reaching down into the hole. I saw a lot of activity that was going on around the bunker itself, and I heard the team leader at the time say, gentlemen, about this calm. Gentlemen, we have to get in this hole. This is what we do. And it was shortly after that I saw the number one operator jump back into the hole. Kevin. He got to the bottom. He turned to the left, immediately felt Ethan, and covered Ethan up with his body. Right behind him, the number two operator and the number three operator engaged Mr. Dykes. Steve. The message came back that the bad guy's down. I think the terminology was, he's down hard. I'm a former SWAT guy, so I understand what that means. Kevin, there was a struggle, and Mr. Dykes was killed in the process. Now, all attention turned to Ethan. Steve, we don't know if Ethan is safe or if he's not. Kevin, I recall the team leader saying, he's crying. Steve, if the little guy is crying, he's breathing, and if he's breathing, we got a chance. And shortly thereafter, out of the smoke-filled hole, pops a red object with blonde hair, and it's the little guy. When we saw him come out, there was still silence until we saw that he was moving. And then there was elation for just a quick point in time, but then the focus went right back to making sure our people were okay. Kevin, I'm just thankful for the whole machine that put this in place that we could rescue Ethan. After the rescue, Ethan briefly lived with his birth mother, but again, social services deemed his home life unstable. That's when the Turner family got a surprise phone call. Nikki Turner said that the same social worker that had been involved with Ethan in the past had called her and told her that Ethan was back in the system, and Nikki adopted him. Ethan is now 13 years old and thriving. He has 9 brothers and sisters, all adopted by the Turners. He rarely talks about being held hostage. A little note here, Ethan said that he actually saw a bullet and smoke, and then the door open. That was when they breached the tunnel, I guess. And another note, there's also now a stretch of highway named after the bus driver Charles Poland, the Charles Poland Memorial Highway. So, that's going to be all I have for you today. Thanks for joining me for this great hour of stuff, and talk to you later and have a great day.